Return to Camp Blood, Episode 15, What About Rob? With Eric Anderson. This episode is brought to you by CNV Promotions. Welcome to another episode of Return to Camp Blood. I'm your host, Chris, joined by my fellow counselors, E.
What's going on, folks?
Eric.
What's up, y'all?
And Oz.
What's up, everybody?
You may have noticed back in our final chapter episode, campbloodpodcast.com/9, that we didn't talk much about Rob, even though he's arguably one of the best characters in the film. And no, I didn't put that in there to kiss your ass. I already had that in my notes.
you can kiss my ass. That's fine.
Not the first time he's heard that.
And to help with this task, we have with us Eric Anderson, the guy who played Rob. How's it going tonight, Eric?
I'm good. We had a little rain out here in California, which is all really rare for July. So we're kind of liking it for the first time. We haven't had a lot of water fall on the ground here, so we're pretty excited that our lawns are getting soaked for, you know, the next 24 hours or so.
So Eric's joining us last minute. We really didn't even know that he would be on the show tonight, so we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hook us up.
Thank you.
It's
so
a really
much.
Good time. It's between the U.S. men's national team soccer game and my beloved San Diego Padres playing at 5:40, so I'm in good shape.
Right on. Rather than this being a regular interview, what we thought we'd do is we were going to do this episode anyway, where we talk about Rob in the film. Mm-hmm. So it'd be just you, like, being one of our co-hosts, talking about the film with us, if you don't mind.
That's fine. You just you run the show. You let me know when I can fill in for you.
Hey, feel free to jump in anytime you think you need to, man.
Okay.
This is all about you, sir.
Well, no, it's not about me. It's all about Rob.
All about Rob.
Correct.
Hey, let's ask this question. I have a question for you. How do you spell Rob's last name?
D-I-E-R.
He beat me.
And, you know, I think in the script it was D-Y-E-R, just so you know.
Oh, was it?
I have to go and look that up. But I think it was D-Y-E-R.
Pronounced the same way, Dyer?
Dyer, yeah, which I thought was kind of weird, but kind of foreshadowing, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Dyer is the one who dies.
Okay, so Rob comes to us in the film, and he is apparently Sandra's brother from part two.
Right.
The problem with Rob's character is that it seems like he's been, you know, he acts like in the film that he's been following the legend of Jason for years, even though he would have had no way to know much about him outside of, at this point, Alice's story about a little boy in the lake.
Right.
I mean, because Crazy Ralph died on the 12th of what was it, June?
What's that you say?
You're going to Camp Blood, ain't you? You'll never come back again. It's got a death curse.
All right, so most of the killing in part two happens on the 13th. Now, and then part three happened on the 14th, possibly the 15th, making part four happening no later than the 16th. So there's only days apart where Sandra was killed, and then Rob shows up at Crystal Lake.
Right, but let's examine the other side of the equation, which is the suspension of belief required by an audience in general.
See, I told you.
and the fact that it's been a year, almost a year and a half since part three has come out, when part four gets released. Is that about right?
Yep.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
and only true nerds are really going to care about this specific thing, right? Oh, wait. I'm talking to them right now.
Yes, yeah, we are. Resemble that remark.
Very much so. We own it.
We embrace our nerdiness.
I will tell you this, that when I sat down with Joe Zito on the night before we shot, I did not know I'd never seen the first three films, I knew that I was playing this character, and I asked him what we were trying to accomplish with this character. And he said, have you seen these movies? And I said, no. And Corey Feldman, I think, was close by. He was, like, laughing at me because he, of course, had seen everyone. He knew all the history of everything associated with it. And I was like, no, I'm playing this guy. And I'm playing this guy as completely as I'm not taking any history of what takes place prior to this. I want you to tell me how you want this guy to go for the purposes of your narrative, for the purpose of part four, this final chapter. And he says, I want to make it really simple for you, Eric. There, in these movies, there are a bunch of kids that are really stupid and they get killed. And when they get killed, the audience cheers. Our goal would be for that when you die, no one cheers. And that's basically what we, basically how I approached everything in a certain way, was not to be stupid.
Yeah, you brought a level of intensity that was just awesome. I mean, for the final chapter, except for Rob's clandestine adventure to go after an unstoppable force. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's my point.
When I was in a movie theater on opening night on April 13th, 1984, I was sitting next to a girl who I didn't know. I brought 20 of my friends to go see the movie. 14 of them were in the lobby by the time the hockey mask blows up at the opening credits. And, but this girl sitting next to me, when I did that, when I went back down the stairs, when I hand her the machete and I head back down the stairs, the girl sitting next to me goes, this guy is so stupid, I don't even believe it.
You know, with regard to that scene, I actually have a question related to that. Like the whole he's killing me thing, was that scripted or was that like just something
you Yeah, in a way. Yeah, it was that night. You know, we're shooting well into the mornings. We're having to shoot nights. So when you're shooting nights, you know, you're getting to work. This is the winter time, it's Topanga Canyon, it's pretty cold. We get into work about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and we start shooting when it gets dark. And so we shoot until 5 or 6 the next morning. And this is probably about 3 or 4 in the morning. I had been going to Tom Savini for the entire movie and saying, I see how you're going to kill Crispin. I see how you're going to kill this guy. How are you going to kill me? And Tom says, we're talking about that. And I didn't know that him and Joe were kind of discussing how that was going to be. Because in the script, it says that I get my throat ripped out by a 3-pronged gardening harrow.
Oh, that would have been nice.
And, well, in the end, Joe decided that not to give the audience that visceral, the relief associated with me being killed in a kind of a gruesome fashion. He wanted it to be entirely psychological.
Right.
And he had had an experience or was in New York during a time when there's a guy, I told the story a lot, but there was a guy on the street and somebody kept approaching to rob him with a knife and started stabbing him. And he's screaming out, he's killing me, he's killing me. And everyone kind of looked, opened their window and looked down at the guy and then closed their window and went on. And this guy ended up dying in the street. It was a big deal in New York at the time about what's our responsibility as citizens in regards to dealing with an act of violence that's happening right in front of us. And Joe was very affected by that. And so he began to formulate this idea that this would be the psychological terror that he would try to put into the film. Because after I die, who's left? You know, it's just the kid and the final girl to face this unstoppable force. And the idea was to send the movie into another level by not showing the visceral, giving the audience a visceral experience of me being gruesomely killed that way with blood flying everywhere.
Yeah, see, I had always assumed that maybe to avoid some extra ratings that they cut it from the final film. But you're saying that
that was a narrative.
You didn't
choice.
Even shoot it.
Yeah, no, we never even shot it. In fact, it was discussed. Only in the moments right before we did shoot it. It was funny. Now, I thought at the time was, oh, they don't want to spend the money. You know, they don't want to spend the money for that effect, you know, because we were, well, you know, Joe, we had a 6-week schedule. We're in week 10 now. We've had Christmas and people have had time off and been paid for their time off. And now we've come back after Christmas to shoot. This is, everyone that was involved in the financial aspects of this picture were losing their mind at this point. And because Joe Zito had a way that he wanted to get it right for whatever, for this audience, for whatever he wanted to try to achieve, he was going to get it right. And I've been told this in multiple situations that he accomplished his goal, that of all the movies, this one is the most fleshed out on a lot of levels, on casting, on character, on, I think people really like Ted White as Jason in this movie. And it's because it took twice as long to make this picture as any of the other ones that were ever shot.
It shows.
And it was because we just kept going on. And you know, it got to the point where you'd get a schedule when you left, for the next day. And you just laugh at it because you knew that it was not going to be that. You'd come to work and sometimes you would sit the whole day in full makeup and never go to the set because they were working on something else at the time. So it was pretty crazy. It was one of the most freeform, almost like a 70s movie to me. Almost like, if I'd gotten a chance to work with some of the maverick directors of the 70s, like Coppola or those guys, Cimino, there was a much more freeform production than anything I've ever worked on in that way. And, that was really the most enjoyable part of it for me. It was, I didn't know what was going to happen when I went, you know, if I was going to work that day or not, but I was on the set. I read a lot of books. I got to watch every effect. I got to watch every stunt. And I was the only guy on the whole movie. I guess Kimberly and I were the only people on the whole movie that were there for all 12 weeks. Everyone else was killed off at some point. Crispin, Lauren, Alan, the twins. When they were killed off, you never saw them again. Right.
Right.
But I was there for the whole 12 weeks. So that was great. That was the best part of it, I think, for me, in a lot of ways. Anyway, I'm rambling. But. Oh, let me ask you guys a continuity question real quick, because somebody came up to me at the convention and asked me this question. And when I hand Trish the machete and she goes back up the stairs, the next shot is her, the machete's in the other hand or something like that. And I thought, I never noticed that. Did you guys notice that?
That's something that I personally didn't ever realize.
I just watched it last night and didn't notice.
You'll have to look at it. I somebody said that to me and I said, you know, I can't help you there because I didn't, you know, yeah. If it happened, it was a pretty terrifying part of the movie with the stair breaking and his hand grabbing her leg and stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the more intense, final chases of the series, I think.
Definitely.
And I think that's
anecdote is that. When we hit the door, we get to the door, and I reach down and I pull the knife out of my boot.
Oh.
And we go in. I got the dog there. They got rain towers. You know, I didn't know when I accepted this movie that I was going to, the last 45 pages of the film are night rain. I just had been cast in the role based upon a couple scenes that I read as an audition piece. So I didn't know that I was going to have to go through this kind of like semi boot camp thing where for continuity's sake, you know, they hose you down in 35 degree weather because you've already been out in the rain, right? So we kept shooting the scene. It got very muddy there and, we almost slipped a couple times. If you see the shot that's in the movie, the dog actually crossed in front of me and I had to get the dog out of the way because I was going to go head ass over kettle right there because there was nowhere to go. And I get to the door and then I pull the knife out of my boot and then we go in and that's the end of the shot. So the first time we do it, I take the knife and I told the top guy, no, give me the real thing. I want to know what it feels like to be in the thing to be in my hand, how heavy it is and stuff like that. And so he does, you know, he does what I tell him. And then of course I go to put the knife back in my boot, the little sheath that's in my boot and I miss it and put it right in my ankle.
Oh man.
And, I am a young actor who does not want to cause trouble, so I don't tell anybody. But I've got a pretty good laceration in my ankle that's going to require up to about 12 stitches. And my boot is filling up with real blood. And we shot, I think, two or three more times, and that was the end of the day. And I went to the doctor. I went to the emergency room right after that. And I don't think anyone in the movie knew that I had done that to myself. Also, I felt like an absolute idiot, you know, so. That was pretty funny.
Wow.
When I see that scene, that's the first thing I think of is, oh yeah, that's when I put the knife in my ankle.
Now I get it. Yeah, that's going to be something I get to think of whenever I see it. My question for you is, whenever you're at your tent and you hear Paul screaming when he's getting harpooned, why grab a machete and not the 30-30?
Boy, you know, I mean, I'm not asking those questions at that point. Part of the reason was, I don't know. I that's a good point. I don't know.
He may have needed to make a path through the weeds. You know, you never know.
Yeah, you guys, you know, this is something for the screenwriter or for Joe. This is not for me. I mean, I didn't turn around and go, "Hey, why am I not grabbing the rifle here?" Because the fact is, I didn't know. I think they said somebody. I didn't know who it was who was screaming when we shot it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was screaming, and I'm supposed to react to that. And I think that actually might have actually been a different reaction to something else, and they kind of created that I would hear that or something. I don't remember stuff. Some of the stuff that was put together in the editing room was not in the script either. And I'm trying to think of what those things were. I'm not really sure.
You
nerd guys like this, you're not asking the right dude.
Well, hey, man, you're Rob. But
I am Rob. But that doesn't mean I'm just trying to make sure that people, nobody claps when I die. And I have to tell you that when I did die that night on April 13th, 1984, at the Fox Hollywood, I think it was at that theater. Nobody did clap, and I felt pretty good about that.
Nice.
Yeah, the only problem I had with Rob's death scene was that, given that he was set up to be this guy who was hunting down the mass killer, and then just to have Rob die in such a...
Okay, but think about it this way. Think about it this way. Think about why Rob's out there to begin with, right? Ostensibly, he's out there to avenge Sandra's death, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. A somewhat chivalrous act to kill the man who killed his sister. And then in the moment when it's do or die for him, he hands the girl the machete in another chivalrous act and goes and confronts the killer himself to give the girl time to get away.
Yeah, that was kind of our consensus too. But still it seems like they could have written you a more glorious death than that.
my point was
unceremonious.
Yeah.
Would it have been more ceremonious if my throat had been ripped away by a gardening tool?
No. I think it's not necessarily that. It's just like how it seemed like he was saying, like the character was building up to be like something way bigger, and then it kind of, you know, it turned out a little differently, you know.
Yeah, it sort of seems like, you know, they kind of build Rob up.
Yeah, the intention is to build me up to think that I'm actually going to be able to save the day, and then you wipe me out, and then who's left? Nobody.
Yeah. And now
it's just a girl and a kid. You know?
That's fair enough. That's fair enough.
I never saw it from that perspective, but yeah, that makes absolute sense.
Joe was going for this thing with Rob where, yeah, you kill the kids or whatever, but he was going for this thing. Is there another movie, is there another character in any of the Friday movies that is actually stalking Jason?
No, but in the reboot, they have another character who is looking for his sister, okay. Much the same way Rob was. But I don't think he knows anything about Jason at that point in the movie.
No, and his sister was missing. She wasn't dead, so it was a little bit different, too.
Okay, because I think that was part of the narrative. You know, I know these things are a little formulaic in the way that they go about telling the story. And that was the difference in this one, was the Rob character kind of broke the formula just a little bit, in the sense that there was really someone who was actually pursuing Jason at that point, that you might have, if you care to, want to put your faith in that maybe he could do something. And then, as it turns out, I can't. and that should make you more terrified. But that was, I think, what the writer and the director were going for at that point.
That's a fair point. I didn't even see it from that perspective, like our Eric said.
Yeah, you explained that about as well as it could have been.
Yeah.
My one question is that I know we already talked about a little bit about how Rob didn't really seem to put up much of a fight against Jason. I mean, I never really expected him to save the day, but I kind of thought that he was built up to kind of give Jason a run for his money, and at least that he would die hard, you know, at least, you know, do some damage, you know what I mean? And I was just kind of surprised. I mean, was that ever discussed that, you know, maybe more of a struggle between Jason and Rob before Rob succumbs to and is finally killed by Jason?
It's a good question. No, it wasn't. There wasn't going to be a battle royale between Rob and Jason. Jason is just too... Somebody you guys had called him an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what... I always kind of looked at that scene a lot as a bit of a self-sacrifice, you know. And I played as an actor, I thought about the fact that my sister was dead, that here was another girl who was going to die because of this guy. And I was just going to try to not let it happen. So I was going to go down there and try to stop him.
Right.
You know, I don't know if Rob was scared too, you know. I mean, when he comes back to the tent and finds the rifle mangled and
he's like, oh shit.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He's you know, he's not this guy. I mean, he's not Chuck Norris or something like that. He's just the guy whose sister got killed, and he's trying to do the right thing, you know.
I think at that point is when he realized he was over his head, when he goes back to the tent and sees he's too far in to retreat at that point.
After Rob gets thrown through the window and is laying there on the floor with the hammer in his head, how long did you actually spend there?
That's the gardening harrow. That's the three-pronged gardening harrow.
Oh, that's what you're getting here. Oh.
Yeah, that's what I got. Hey, sweet. Shut up. My dog.
Is that Gordon?
It's funny. The current dog that I have has got a little Gordon in her.
Well, hey, maybe he's the one we should ask. Did Gordon commit suicide, or what was what happened with Gordon?
Good question. I don't know what happened to Gordon. I think that's a really good question about Gordon. I think he'd know what he wanted to deal with it from a, you know, animal rights perspective.
You just got to,
because I would have cared more about Gordon than any of those kids, to tell you the truth. Anyway, because I'm a dog lover, but. You mentioned, I'm sorry, you were talking about the fact that is the, actually, have you ever seen a poster? There's a cool poster out there. I've signed it a couple of times. It has all the tools that Jason used to kill somebody.
No.
Have you guys ever seen that poster?
No, but I want it.
It might be a British one. Have you guys not seen that?
No.
No, I haven't seen it.
It's really cool. It's a really it's Friday the 13th, and it had basically, I think the 13 is created out of all these, every tool that Jason used in every one of the movies leading up to the reboot, right? And I was like, do you have mine? Because you don't see, except if you look closely when I'm on the floor, you don't see the tool that he used to kill me. And, but there it is. It's sitting there. It's a three-prong gardening harrow. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You know what a harrow is?
Yeah. I think you see it for a quick second when he reaches for it, but.
Exactly. And it's in the basement. And so that's what's coming out of my neck at that point. And that was a fun week for me when they killed Jason, because I had to get fully made up, get hosed down, and then lay on the floor for a week because they were killing Jason. You know, it's one of the things is I ran into Tom Savini just recently, and you guys will really, you might like the story or you might really not like it, but. You know, he did the first one, right? Mm-hmm. And they have him, they ask him back for the second. Was it the second one or not? But he did do two? No.
He didn't do two. They asked him to, but he did another. He chose to do another film.
So he says, you know, Jason is dead. You know, he says the whole thing about him coming out of the lake is he's dead. That's why Betsy Palmer, that's why she's killing the kids, because they neglected Jason. Jason's dead. So how can Jason be alive again was his thing. So when he came back for part four, I guess part three was shot, his intention was to make it beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jason was dead. And he only accepted the job because he wanted to make sure that everyone knew that Jason was dead, which is right. why a machete through the brain of Jason signifies that Jason is dead. I thought that was very interesting. And of course, then he has nothing good to say about anything that goes beyond part four.
Do you have any other, any, you know, favorite stories of anything that, you know, any interactions with the cast, you know, behind the scenes or anything like that on set that you could share with us?
Yeah, I have a couple. My favorite first one was the very first day of shooting. I told this story before, but when we gathered up in Buellton, California at the Anderson's Pea Soup, the hotel that motel is there. I call it the Pea House, but it's not. And, it's the Best Western up there in Buellton. And we shot the early strip and disc stuff and the stuff on the road, when I first come across their car. And, we shot that up in Santa Barbara County. And then we moved to Topanga. We actually moved to a reservoir, up above Beverly Hills. And then we moved to Topanga Canyon for all the house stuff. And the cool thing was about the temporary house that was built, the kid's house, was there were stairs going up, right? Well, those are the same stairs that are going down in the basement after they finished shooting all the upstairs stuff, you know, because they just built a two-story set. So we're in Buellton at this thing, and it's October 31st. It's Halloween night. And when we all kind of arrived at the hotel and I met everybody for the first time, and Corey's grandfather maybe was his guardian. He was there with him. And so Kimberly and I took, and he was a jerk. And
Corey?
Corey's 12 years old. Corey is an innocent, sweet, innocent kid who just desperately wants to be loved. And so Corey, Kimberly and I take Corey, he's got a Michael Myers mask, actually, and we take him trick-or-treating in the neighborhood behind the hotel, where the motel was. And it was a pretty fabulous neighborhood. I mean, they were really into Halloween. They really did it up, right? And he got to trick-or-treat, and we got to kind of have this rehearsal of getting to know each other, and she got to have this thing of, oh, this is my little brother, right? Mm-hmm. And that was basically, the next day we were off shooting as that time went on. But the next day, during a lull, I said to Corey, you know, what have you been in? And he goes, not knowing that he maybe had done something before, but young actors sometimes have done a lot. I hadn't been very much at all, a couple of TV shows and a movie that's never going to ever be released at that point. And Corey said, I was the kid in The Shining. And I looked at him, I went, really? And he goes, yeah. And I knew he wasn't the kid in The Shining, right?
I was going to say, I don't think that was Corey.
No, it wasn't Corey. But the fact is that the fact that he felt the need to tell me that was a real good indication that there was something that was a little amiss there, and that he felt the need that he had to impress, you know, that he felt an insecurity in some way, even as a 12-year-old. And then it's funny because within an hour, he came to me and said, you know what? I wasn't the kid in The Shining. I said, I knew you weren't, but if you want to believe you are, that's okay with me. So that was a very interesting. That was the beginning of our relationship throughout that thing. And for the entire time after that movie was made, and for the next, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 years, I would run into Corey at a premiere or a screening or something would be going on, and he would come up to me, and I was like his older brother. He was just like, he was very respectful, and all the stuff that happened afterwards, that was that I didn't know him during that period of time in his life. But ironically, at the Horror Hound, which is one of you guys from Cincinnati, right?
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, I was at Horror Hound a couple of years ago, and Corey was there, and I went to go over and say hi to him, and he had no idea who I was. So, but that was the thing. And also, Crispin Glover was an interesting cat. I knew that he was going to have some kind of a career beyond that.
Yeah,
Lawrence and I had actually been in an acting class together many years before we shot this movie. And so I knew him already. And Kim Beck, you know, I met her on this picture, and uh, I I kind of had a crush on her, and I thought she was just a really interesting person. And it's funny, we ran into each other at Monster Mania maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, she was just a great spirit. She was a great person to be around. I mean, in those days, my car was broken half the time. So she would have to pick me up and take me to work and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's funny. It's a different time.
Old boot knife to the solenoid didn't work.
What?
You got to carry that boot knife around. You got to be careful, though. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that about Horror Hound, and I've got actually Final Chapter is my favorite of the series for a lot of the reasons that we talked about, that you had mentioned with, you know, Joe and the detail that
taking the extra time. Yeah.
Right. And I think that really, really shows through. And, you know, Ted White is my favorite Jason of all the series. I met him a couple of times. He's a great guy. My final chapter poster. You were the first cast member that I got to sign it at Horror Hound. I get a lot of compliments on it because you signed it, "He's Killing Me," and everybody loves it.
Nice.
Loves that. Because
it's pretty much no offense, but it's pretty much everyone's request when I do sign something.
Well, it's even better because I didn't request it. You just did it. I mean, and that's kind of how I do it. I just let, you know, if they tend to personalize most of the people I meet, but I let them pick what line or whatever, right, from a film that they wanted. And it's great. And I met Judy Aronson and Peter Barton last year. And, you know, they were complimenting me on it. Oh, you know, you got Eric Anderson on here. And I was like, yeah, he was the first one to sign it. And, you know, Judy signed it Strip and Dip. And Peter signed it, "Drop My Bar of Soap, Old Buddy." You know, it's
those
great.
People, I mean, people are awesome. You know, I would run into them all the time. I still run into them occasionally. And we all, there's something really great about, I mean, to think of something that was, we shot in 83. So what is that? 32 years ago. 32 years ago.
Oh, man.
Oh, you know, I was in Atlantic City with Ted White. And I'm going to Sweden with Ted White actually in December. And, I got to sit with him for the first time in 30 years when we were in Atlantic City last summer. And,
oh, wow.
That guy's a stud, man. That guy is just a stud. He's just the greatest guy. He's 84 years old or something like that. I mean, he was 50 when he made, you know.
Well, he was on the panel. They did like that mini reunion at Horror Hound last year. You know, Peter and Judy was there, and you know, Ted White was there and on the panel. And believe it or not, I mean, he was the one that everybody loved. I mean, he had everybody laughing. I mean, he was just
he's so funny. He's so smart. Man.
Yeah,
I mean, he's a guy who's double John Wayne.
Right,
that's what I was talking about before. I think that's, I mean,
you
so
got to
awesome.
Be a you got to be a stud to be John Wayne's stump.
Yeah,
but I need
much
Kim's
to get him to tell those stories either. It's pretty awesome.
Oh, he loves it. He loves it. I've met him. I met him twice, and both times he's, you know, just stand there and talk to you as long as you want. I almost to the point where you feel guilty. People are standing behind you wanting to meet him, and I'm like, you know, this is great. But yeah, I would love to get Kim Beck's, you know, signature on my poster and meet her too. You're not the only one who had a crush on her.
Monster Manor, she was there, and we're trying someday, you know, Chris Carbaugh, who puts me together, and Stacey Fountain, who put me together for these things. We're trying to do the thing where we get as many of the cast as we can at one of these things and let everyone know we're going to be there. So, and that would include Kimberly and Judy and Peter and me. Corey and Crispin and all those people would be there. So,
oh, Crispin and Lawrence,
Carrie and Camilla, for all I know. I don't think is out there is Barbara Howard. She's
kind of distanced herself from the whole. She doesn't even like to be associated with the whole Friday thing for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, she's not part of it.
But hey, I do want to say, you know, my son and I met you, you know, at Cincinnati Horror Hound a couple years ago, and It was an absolute pleasure to meet you, my friend.
I always have a good time with those things. You know, I now only do them with my buddy Kim, and because we don't get to see each other,
Kim Coates?
We're both kind of busy on our own things. And
you guys were both there at the same time, yeah.
Yeah, and we were sitting next to each other, right?
Right.
Only together. I think the next thing we're going to maybe do is Chiller in New Jersey in October. Him and I are going. Yeah, and then we're going to go to Sweden in December. But we only do it together now because we just say, hey, if we're going to see each other, let's just do it over that time. And then we get to have dinner and see each other. He's so busy. I'm just so busy right now. And it's just like, it's great. It's great that we get to go and do it together.
Right.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
So what are you up to now? I mean, what kind of?
Well, I'm actually doing a play. And it's going to have a very short run next week. I'm going to rehearse for about 6 weeks. And that's where I started. I started as a stage actor, and now I'm getting to kind of come full circle with it. And I really have had a really great time. And then I think I'm going to go do a movie with another friend of Kim's and mine, Billy Fichtner. I'm going to do a movie with him in August. And awesome. I've been writing novels too, so I have my third book is in the process of being written. I have two books out right now, so the third one's being written right now. Long, boring science fiction books. So,
hey, I might pick those up. I'm a sci-fi like
five.
Fan.
They're 500 pages, so yeah, it's a commitment. Let me tell you.
All right, Eric. I know you got some baseball to get to, so we will. We will let you go, but again, man, we really appreciate you coming on the show, especially at such short notice.
Very much.
No problem. You can, in the end, you can thank Stacy and Chris for that. They're the ones who got in touch with me today to do this for you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a good time, you guys, and don't get too nerdy.
that's our thing, man.
I know. Hey, Ed, if I'm ever at one of these things that is in your hometown or whatever. Make sure you come up and say hi to me, okay?
Oh, definitely. Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Final thoughts about Rob before we close the show out tonight.
I dig the character. I mean, when I first saw it when I was a kid, Rob was, you know, my favorite character next to Tommy, because Tommy was closer to my age and he was into video games and all that nerdy shit and masks and all like I was. But I thought Rob was a cool character. And, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, I do wish that he kind of put up more of a fight, but after talking to Eric, you know, I kind of understand, you know, I understand he was being gallant and you know, trying to provide the window, even though it meant his demise. He's trying to provide the window for Trish and Tommy to get away. So I can respect that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that was essentially my thing as far as Rob's character. I just thought, you know, just seeing what was going on, that he was being built up to be something bigger, like a bigger, I don't know, a bigger threat to Jason himself. But, you know, having the way Eric explained it, you know, it makes more sense to me now why he went out like he did, you know, just because he thought he was going to be more. And it turned out, wow, this guy can't do shit either.
He had to face Jason with a boot knife. He did the chivalrous thing, like you said. And I think that's awesome.
I didn't ever think that he was going to take Jason out, but I mean, I thought that he'd do a little more damage, I guess is what.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You can support the show as always by rating us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to the show at. If you want to support us financially, check out campbloodpodcast.com/donate for options. If you want to ask us a question or vindicate a theory you might have, you can contact the show by sending an email to feedback@campbloodpodcast.com. You can also text or leave us a voicemail at 757-637-0216. Until next time.
You're going to Camp Blood, ain't you? You'll never come back again. It's got a death curse.
Return to Camp Blood is a proud member of the Tangent Bound Network.